Vivian Godin was being brought out of the woods in a body bag. The bistro door opened and Carl Tracy stepped out into the fresh air and sunshine. He saw the stretcher, took a deep breath and said,
"I wonder."
"What?" demanded Olivier, coming out behind him.
"I wonder if she was insured."
Staring silently at the long black bag as it was slid into the coroner's vehicle, Homer Godin crossed himself, as did Gabri and Olivier. Even Ruth, unseen by the others, made the familiar gesture. After the coroner's vehicle drove away, Vivienne's father closed his eyes and tilted his head as far back as it would go, exposing his throat to the universe. "Chief Inspector," said Beauvoir, as he came around the corner from the path along the river. He indicated Homer, clearly in custody, by the car.
"I'll explain," said Gamache, then instructed Cameron to take Godin into the local detachment. "Don't book him. I'll be in to do the paperwork later. Make him comfortable, but don't let him out of your sight."
Cameron turned to Homer.
"I'm sorry, sir. Would you mind?"
Homer got into the back seat without complaint. As Cameron went to walk to the driver's side, Gamache stopped him.
"One moment, please. I have a question for you."
He led Cameron a few feet from the car.
"Was the child yours?"
Cameron's eyes widened.
"No, of course not. I told you, nothing happened between Vivian and me."
"You knew she was pregnant before we said anything. She told you. Is the child yours? Tell me the truth."
"I am. It's not mine. Couldn't be."
"I think you're lying. I think there's a lot you aren't telling us. I understand you're worried about your family, your job, but you know it'll come out. Best if you tell us yourself."
"There's nothing to tell."
Gamache pressed his lips together and gave a single curt nod.
"You're helping a murderer."
"How?"
"By muddying the waters. By leaving questions unanswered. Questions we have to now take precious time investigating."
"I have answered them, but not truthfully."
Gamache made a mental note to call the Alouettes organization and ask why they'd let Bob Cameron go, and why no other football team picked him up.
"May I go with him, sir?"
Lisette Cloutier asked Chief Inspector Beauvoir. He looked at her a moment. "Why?"
"Why? Because he's my friend. He's just lost his daughter."
Beauvoir nodded. "Is it possible, Agent Cloutier, that you're more than friends?"
"More? No. I care about him. But his wife was the one who was my friend. My best friend. I was maid of honour at their wedding."
"When did she die?"
5 years ago, ovarian cancer."
"I'm sorry." He paused. "You've kept up a relationship with Monsieur Godin?"
"There is no relationship. Not in the way I think you mean. We're old friends, that's all."
On seeing Beauvoir's scepticism, she pressed her lips together before nodding.
"All right. You're right. But my relationship isn't with Homer. It's with Vivian. She was my goddaughter."
She dropped her gaze and studied her muddy boots before lifting her head and looking him straight in the eyes. Perhaps, he thought, a little too straight.
"I should have told you sooner, but I was afraid."
"Of what?"
"That you'd think I was too close, that you'd take me off the case."
"You're right. I probably would have." Cloutier shook her head.
"I've screwed up everything. I promised Catherine I'd look after her daughter, keep her safe. I made that promise at the baptism, and I made it again at her deathbed. I didn't do a good job of it, did I? But what I can do now is help catch her killer. That's all I want."
"And Homer Godin?"
"What about him?"
"More than professional interest?"
"Of course not."
"You took his hand?"
"I was trying to comfort him. Haven't you ever held the hand of a mother or father of a murder victim to console them?"
Beauvoir had to admit he never had. He'd seen Chief Inspector Gamache do it, and he himself had reached out, come within inches of that brute sorrow, but something stopped him every time. They were different men, with different strengths, and maybe he thought that was one of the many reasons he was leaving the Sûreté, heading to Paris. He knew, deep down, that there was a level, deep down, he could never reach as an investigator. While Jean-Guy Beauvoir explored the tangible, what could be touched, Armand Gamache explored what was felt. He went into that chaotic territory, hunting, searching, tracking, immersing himself in emotions until he found one so rancid it led to a killer. Beauvoir stopped at the door, Gamache went through it. Which wasn't to say Beauvoir was insensitive to feelings. Watching Agent Cloutier, he'd picked up on hers. There was something between her and Homer Godin, he was sure of it. Though he doubted Godin knew that. He wondered if Cloutier had even admitted it to herself.
May I go with them, sir?
She asked again. Beauvoir looked over at Homer. As though the day wasn't bad enough, now he found himself alone in the back of a police car, while the man who killed his daughter was standing in the sunshine. Go. He might not be able to hold Homer's hand, but he could offer comfort in other ways. Clara, Myrna, and Ruth stepped back as the cop car passed them. Ruth shook her head and looked over at Gamache and Beauvoir, conferring on the village green.
Shouldn't there be a third stooge?
Just then, another car arrived.
Never mind, spoke too soon.
Isabel Lacoste got out and walked, limping slightly, over to her two colleagues.
Was that Monsieur Godin in the back of the patrol car? Lacoste asked. Is he under arrest?
Gamache explained to both of them what he'd done and why.
I know Renmarie won't press charges. It was an accident. But maybe we can hold him long enough to collect evidence.
Against Tracy, oui, said Beauvoir, glancing over his shoulder at the man lounging like a reptile in the early April sun.
He turned to Lacoste and Gamache.
Walk with me, please.
Isabel raised her brows in amusement and wondered if Gamache recognized those words. It was something he'd often said to them during murder investigations. Now they fell into step and waited for Beauvoir to speak.
What do you think? He said.
This one might be difficult, said Lacoste, proving she was murdered.
Is it possible she wasn't? Asked Gamache.
Beauvoir considered, glancing over at Tracy, then back to his two colleagues.
Possible, I suppose, but I don't believe it was an accident or suicide. Do you?
Not for a moment, said Lacoste.
Gamache nodded. It was murder. He knew that. What he didn't know was whether they could prove it.
Did you know that Agent Cloutier was Vivian Godin's godmother? Beauvoir asked.
Huh, said Gamache. Why didn't she tell us that before?
Said she was afraid of being taken off the case. But I'm not convinced. Why keep that a secret unless there's more there?
Gamache then told them about Bob Cameron.
Mad, said Beauvoir. He was having an affair with her?
Denies it, said Gamache.
You don't believe him?
Asked Lacoste.
I don't.
You think he might have killed Vivian?
Beauvoir couldn't keep the skepticism out of his voice.
I think he and Vivian were much more involved than he admits. And where there are secrets,
there's fire. What do you think happened?
I think one possible scenario is that they arranged to meet on that side road by the bridge, where they wouldn't be seen. If she told him then that the child was his, and that she'd left Tracy to be with him.
Is he married?
Lacoste asked.
Oui, with two children.
You think in a moment of madness he pushed her off the bridge? She said.
Or just pushed her away and she fell against the railing. I've seen him play. He's strong. And it's a sort of instinctive move a left tackle makes.
Gamache mimicked the pushing motion. It wouldn't take much for Vivian to break through the railing and fall.
And he just left?
Asked Lacoste.
Once she was in the water, he couldn't save her, even if he wanted to.
Once again, and just for an instant, Gamache felt himself submerged in the bitterly cold water, unable to breathe.
And now he's too afraid to admit anything, said Beauvoir.
Still, do you think that's what happened?
It didn't take Gamache long to answer that.
No.
We all know who did this, said Lacoste.
Bon, said Gamache, and turned to continue walking.
But when he realized Beauvoir had not joined him, he stopped and returned.
There's something I'd like to ask you, said Jean-Guy.
Oui?
Reine-Marie had walked around the village green and joined Olivier and Gabri outside the bistro.
"Jesus, he did hit you, didn't he?" said Gabri, looking at the bruise on her face. "You okay?"
"Nothing Honoré hasn't done, also by accident."
She touched her bruised cheekbone lightly.
"I put frozen peas on it."
They brought her up to speed on what had happened, and as they talked, she took another few steps away from Carl Tracy, who was sitting at a table on the terrace, drinking a beer, at 8 in the morning.
"Does that remind you of anything?" Olivier asked. "A clown in a sewer?" Gabri suggested. "No, not him. Them."
Olivier gestured toward the 3 Sûreté officers on the village green. Reine-Marie cocked her head, staring, and then she gave a short puff of amusement and recognition. Isabel, Jean-Guy, Armand. 3 colleagues, 3 friends, a trinity, sturdy, eternal, together.
3 pines, she said.
3 stooges, said Ruth,
as she walked by and entered the bistro. "I know I assigned this to you, that you're the lead investigator, but do you mind if I take over?" Before Gamache could answer, Beauvoir held up his hand. "I know it's a lot to ask."
"You have a perfect right to assume command of any investigation. May I ask why?"
"This will probably be my last case with the Sûreté, with any police force. This is the one I want to go out on." When Gamache didn't answer, Beauvoir asked, "What is it?"
"Have you thought that maybe this isn't the one you want as your final case?"
"What do you mean?"
"We're pretty sure we know who did it."
"More than pretty sure, I'd say. Tracy all but admits it."
"He admits he beat Vivienne, not that he threw her off the bridge. He keeps insisting it was suicide, and we're going to have a hell of a problem proving it wasn't at least an accident. And, as you said, even if we can prove it's murder, it might be extremely difficult to convict the man."
"We've had more difficult cases," said Lacoste.
"True.
Are you reluctant to give it up because of Annie? I've seen how much you sympathize with Gaudin, more than usual."
Armand smiled and nodded. "It's true. This one's gotten under my skin. And, yes, because of Annie. I'm trying not to, but the truth is, I find myself asking how I'd feel if... And even more since you told us Annie's pregnant."
"Pregnant?"
asked Lacoste. When Jean-Guy nodded, she gave him a quick embrace.
"Félicitations."
"Merci."
"I think you feel the same way," said Gamache, "about Vivienne and Annie." "Not really?" Gamache stared at his son-in-law, frankly and openly amazed.
"I beg your pardon?"
"This is a terrible case, absolutely, but I haven't personalized it." There was silence as Gamache watched him, and then spoke.
"You almost killed yourself trying to get to her body," he pointed out. "I've seen you desperate to stop a murderer, but I've never seen you take it so personally."
"I'm not." Then he relented. "Okay, maybe a little. It's hard not to. But I have my feelings well under control, don't worry." Isabel Lacoste looked from one to the other. Both, she knew, were personalizing this. Far more than she'd ever seen. Far more than was healthy. If they weren't worried, she was.
"Bon," said Gamache. "I'm happy to hand over the case. May I act as your second-in-command, patron?"
"For the first time."
"And with luck, the last."
Beauvoir gave a small laugh and put out his hand. "Welcome aboard. I'll try to go easy on you, son. Just don't screw up."
"You inspire me already, Chief Inspector."
"Now, isn't it your nap time?"
"You might want to consider grabbing some sleep yourself," said Gamache. "Long day behind us, and long day ahead."
"Work still to be done. I need to set up an incident room."
"I'm sure your second-in-command can do that."
"You're my second-in-command." Gamache gave a short grunt of laughter and clapped Beauvoir on the arm.
"Well, good luck."
But as he walked away, Armand's smile faded, replaced by a slight frown. He called his RCMP colleague as soon as he got back home. It rang and rang, finally clicking over to voicemail. Gamache looked at his watch. The sun had been up for slightly over an hour. The floodgates at the mighty dams had been open for slightly under an hour. What was happening up there? He left a message, then went upstairs, suspecting he wouldn't be able to sleep. But the moment his head hit the cool, fresh pillow, he was out. Renmarie, also exhausted, had joined him, and in their sleep they moved to the middle until their warm bodies touched. Beauvoir and Lacoste walked past the thick wall of sandbags, pausing to consider them.
"Came close," she said,
pointing to the ones that had been pushed over by the force of the river. Beauvoir grunted. How close they all were, without knowing it, to disaster. All the time. They walked over the stone bridge to the old brick train station. It had seen its share of reunions and partings, its share of tears and shouts of joy. Even he, fairly immune to fantasy, could feel that every time he entered the familiar building. It had also seen its share of murder investigations, having been used in the past by Chief Inspector Gamache as temporary headquarters for the homicide unit. Now Chief Inspector Beauvoir directed his team to set up shop. Abandoned decades earlier by the railway, the building was now home to the Three Pines Volunteer Fire Department, overseen by its chief, Ruth Zardo, who glared down at them from the official photo, taken when she'd been given the Governor-General's Award for poetry. "I didn't feel the aimed word hit," Beauvoir said, looking up at the embittered old poet, "and go in like a soft bullet. I didn't feel the smashed flesh closing over it like water over a thrown stone."
"What was that, Patron?" asked one of the agents.
"Nothing."
"Sounded like poetry," she said with some alarm.
"Keep working." Beauvoir caught Isabel Lacoste's eye and saw amusement there and recognition.
"My God," he thought, "I'm turning into Gamache."
But while he feigned alarm, what he actually felt was a sort of contentment. That on his last case, he should finally turn into his mentor. He stood still amid the activity and let the evidence come to him. But what came to him was an image, clear as day. Young and pregnant Vivian Godin, breaking through the railing, arms out, the duffel bag, her worldly possessions, falling with her. Her blue eyes wide as realization hit. And then the water, cold as ice, closing over her. Like water over a thrown stone. How would I feel if it was Annie? Armour was right, of course. He was struggling to separate the two women. "Does my twisting body spell out grace? I hurt, therefore I am. Faith, charity, and hope are three dead angels falling like meteors." "Always cheerful, eh, you old witch," muttered Jean-Guy as he gave one last glance up at Ruth before turning to examine the sodden items at his feet. They'd found Vivian's purse in the tangle of the dam. Its contents were spread out on the sanitized plastic sheet on the floor, alongside the things from the duffel bag. An agent described each item for the recording as it was removed, tagged, catalogued, photographed, swabbed, examined. Private items transformed, like black magic, into public property. Finally, the entire contents were spread out. From the purse, they'd taken a wallet with $110 in change, driver's license, a bank card but no credit card, some paper, too wet to read, the water having turned it into pulp, some mints, a Bic lighter but no cigarettes, what looked like house keys and car keys.
"Nothing unusual," said Lacoste, but something had caught her eye, taken from the duffel bag.
Wearing gloves, she picked up the pill bottle and sounded out the label.
"Mifejimiso. I don't know it."
"I do," said one of the agents, looking over. "It's an abortion pill."
"You mean the morning after pill?" asked Beauvoir.
"No, that's different. That's for the day after sex, to stop insemination from going further. This is for pregnancies in the first few months, to terminate them."
"I didn't know there was such a thing," said Beauvoir. "Legal?"
"Yes, sir."
"What do you think?"
he asked Lacoste as they stared down at the collection of items.
"I think it's strange that Vivian Godin was beyond 3 months pregnant, and she takes abortion pills with her.
I'm assuming they won't work this far into a pregnancy. If she had the pills, why not use them earlier?
Maybe she thought they would work, said Beauvoir. Maybe she was waiting to see how the father would react, and if it went badly, she'd take them.
This isn't prescription, said Lacoste. There's no doctor or pharmacy on the label, not even her name.
Black market, said Beauvoir.
Seems so. If they're legal, why go onto the black market?
And why would she tell her husband that the baby wasn't his, even if it was true? She must have known how he'd react. Why not just get out while she could, said Beauvoir.
Tracy, goddamn him, had said the same thing. That Vivian knew what he'd do, that he'd hit her, beat her, though surely she never thought he'd kill her.
Maybe she didn't tell him, said Lacoste. We only have Tracy's word for that.
Beauvoir was considering.
Then why would he say it? He gave us a motive. He's clever enough to know that.
He told the chief that they were drunk, said Lacoste. Maybe she didn't mean to tell him, but it just came out. Maybe it wasn't even true.
Beauvoir nodded. He, more than most, understood the corrosive effect of booze, how it stole judgment and inhibitions until things were said and done that could never be unsaid, undone. Alcohol stole dignity and friends and family and livelihoods before finally taking the life. Alcohol was a thief and often a murderer.
She wanted to hurt him before she left, said Lacoste.
She couldn't match him physically, but she could hurt him with words.
The aimed word, like a soft bullet, thought Beauvoir, glancing up at the photo of Ruth scrutinizing them.
Sober Vivian probably knew better, but drunk, said Beauvoir.
The toxicology report will tell us more.
There's something else, said Lacoste. The clothes she packed don't make sense.
Why not?
Where are the sweaters, the heavy shirts, the socks?
There are shirts and jeans.
Summer weight. It's freezing out. Why take those?
Maybe she planned to go south. Florida.
Maybe, said Lacoste.
Or
maybe she packed in a hurry. Just grabbing things.
Or
maybe she didn't pack the bag, said Beauvoir.
Maybe he did.
Lacoste nodded.
To make it look like she'd gone away.
No woman in her right mind would take those clothes in early April.
The problem we're going to have, he said, is proving that Tracy packed the bag. Even if we find his DNA and fingerprints on the items, his defence would argue they were there because they lived together.
Oui,
said Lacoste.
But if his prints are on that,
she pointed to the pill bottle,
we might have something.
I think he tossed it in not knowing what it was.
Not exactly a smoking gun, said Beauvoir. But he could feel hope rising, if not faith and charity. This might be the first nail.
Lisette Cloutier sat in the Sûreté detachment. She'd chosen a desk with direct line of sight into the cells, where she could watch Homer. The sandwiches and coffee she'd taken in were untouched. Lisette had stayed with him for a while, but he seemed lost in his own world, oblivious to her presence. Even, she felt, a little annoyed by it. He clearly wanted just to be left alone. If she couldn't comfort him, there was one thing she could do. Glancing around, making sure she wasn't being watched, she went online, found Carl Tracy's Instagram feed, and typed. Reviewing it, going over each word, changing one, adjusting another, until it was just right. Then she hit send and tapped the pen on the desk, waiting for a reply.
Chapter 19. At Nouveau Gallery. Hello, at Carl Tracy. Love your ceramic pieces. I'm a gallery owner looking for exciting new talent. Can we meet? The phone woke Armand with a start. He was instantly alert and grabbed it before he could wake up Reine-Marie.
Oui, hello?
Sorry to disturb you, said Beauvoir.
Not at all,
said Armand, rubbing his hand across his face and feeling the stubble.
You have news?
The search warrant has come through.
Excellent. I'll meet you at the car in...
He checked the bedside clock. It was 9:40 in the morning. He'd been asleep for just over an hour, but felt refreshed.
20 minutes.
Armand quickly and quietly showered and shaved, not wanting to wake up Renmarie, though he did check and make sure she was okay. The bruise now spread across the left side of her face, but there was little swelling. Still, it hurt him to see it. She roused and opened her eyes, giving a start on seeing his face so close to hers.
"Everything all right?"
she mumbled, still half asleep.
"I'm just going out. You okay?"
That must hurt. He reached out, but didn't touch it, not wanting to add to the pain he knew she must be feeling.
"Well, I now have a much better idea, mon coeur, what you've gone through."
"Me? Oh, no," he said with a smile. "Any time a fist comes even close, I drop to the ground and play dead. Let Jean-Guy sort it out."
"Belly up, feet and hands to the ceiling, like a bug. Yes, I've seen that.
You also do it when Ruth enters a room."
"I'll get you a Tylenol," he said, smiling, and returned a minute later with a couple of pills and a glass of water.
She was sitting up in bed now, and he sat beside her. They talked about Annie and Jean-Guy's news, a brother or sister for Honoré, another grandchild for them. Yet one, neither said, but both knew, who would grow up a continent away.
"There's something I need to tell you."
He did up his tie as he spoke.
"I arrested Homer Godin."
"Yes, I know. You think he killed his daughter?"
"No, but I need to keep him from Tracy. I charged him with assault. For that." He pointed to her face.
"But..."
she began, bringing her own hand to her face.
"I know. I won't follow through. I just needed to get him off the streets, so he won't go after Tracy."
"So this might have been a good thing?"
She touched the bruise.
"No."
He kissed her before getting up.
"Jean-Guy's waiting for me."
"What will you do without him, Armand?"
He opened his mouth, but there was no answer.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I shouldn't have asked."
"No, it's good to talk about it. Jean-Guy reminded me it's less than 2 weeks away."
It wasn't, of course, just losing Beauvoir as a colleague and friend. It was losing Annie and Honoré, and now the new baby. With their son, Daniel, and his wife and two daughters already in Paris, it meant they had no children or grandchildren close by. But for Renmarie, the dread went deeper, something she'd never admitted to Armand. For many years, she'd felt that as long as Jean-Guy was close by, he'd protect Armand. They were meant to be together, had been, in her opinion, for many lifetimes, as colleagues, as father and son, as brothers. As long as they were together, both would be safe. Once downstairs, Armand flicked on the television to cable news and placed a call. As Radio Canada interviewed an increasingly agitated deputy premier about the terrible flooding, Armand waited for the phone to be answered. The phone rang, as the politician tried to explain that it could have been worse. The phone rang as the journalist tried to explain that it was pretty damn catastrophic for those towns that were underwater. Both, Gamache knew, were right. The graphic on the screen showed where work was underway to divert floodwaters upriver. The phone rang, and rang, then clicked over to voicemail. The RCMP commissioner wasn't answering, or couldn't answer. Armand hung up and decided that no news was good news. There was nothing he could do about it now, anyway. He grabbed his coat and joined Beauvoir and Lacoste.
"Knock, knock," said Myrna.
"Who's there?"
asked Clara, not looking up.
"Me."
"Me who?"
"No, this isn't a knock-knock joke," Myrna said, entering the studio. "I just didn't want to startle you. We were supposed to meet at the bistro for breakfast, weren't we?"
"Sorry, I lost track of time."
Myrna sat on the low sofa, her considerable derriere hitting the concrete floor, as it always did. She groaned, more in annoyance than pain. Would she never learn? From her vantage point, essentially on the floor, Myrna could see that Clara was staring at a series of miniatures on her easel.
"I've been sitting here trying to decide if the tweeters are right," Clara explained. "If these are shit."
"I believe we call those people twats. And no, they're not right. And you think that's bad? You should see what they're saying about Armand's return to the Sûreté. Madman with a gun. At least you only have a paintbrush."
How much damage can you do?
You'd be surprised, apparently.
Myrna brought out her phone.
Listen to this.
I don't want to hear it.
Strange, intense, feverish, Myrna read.
Is that about me or Armand?
It's about Van Gogh. Here's another. The museum could have saved a good chunk by getting the plan and having the thing run off by the janitors with rollers. That was a review of an early Barnett Newman. I looked it up. One of his paintings just sold for $84 million.
Dollars?
Dog biscuits.
At that, Leo got to his feet, tail wagging. Myrna dug into her pocket and brought one out before returning to her phone.
He's a madman, desperate for conquest.
Picasso?
Gamache.
Clara made a retching sound.
Just shit. Lies.
So if you know the tweets are wrong about Armand, why don't you know they're wrong about you and your art?
Because one's objective and one's subjective, said Clara.
The record proves that Armand didn't do any of what he's accused of. And what he did do was to save greater pain. He's been investigated exhaustively and cleared.
But what I do,
Clara returned her gaze to the easel,
is open to interpretation. I had an email from my gallery in Montreal. A few collectors are asking about returning the paintings they bought, some from years ago. They're concerned that the value has fallen through, that I'm not a real artist at all, but, what did one tweet call me? A poseur.
Actually, thought Myrna, that was one of the more polite descriptions she'd seen.
Those are just mean people.
Just because it's mean doesn't make it wrong,
said Clara, tilting her head this way and that, examining her works on the easel.
All truth with malice in it, said Myrna.
What did you say?
Just a quote from Moby Dick, said Myrna. Something Armand said yesterday.
You think there's truth in those tweets?
No, I didn't mean that.
Myrna's arms were pinwheeling as she tried to back up the conversation.
There's no truth in them. Believe me, just malice.
But Clara was shaking her head, her confidence shaken.
Come on over for lunch later,
said Myrna, lugging herself off the sofa with a groan.
You need to get out of the studio, and out of your own head.
Or someplace lower? Asked Clara.
All truth, said Myrna, and heard her friend laugh. You know, Moby Dick was also savage when it first came out. Now it's considered one of the great novels of all time.
Clara didn't answer. She'd gone back to staring at the miniatures on her easel. Myrna almost pointed out that what had happened to Vivian Godin, what her father was living, was a tragedy. What Clara was going through was a setback, nothing more. But she didn't. Myrna understood how damaging it was to compare pain, to dismiss hurt just because it wasn't the worst. As she walked back across the bright village green, her feet squelching in the soft turf, Myrna thought about those miniatures Clara had painted. Perhaps, she admitted to herself privately as she walked past the wall of sandbags, not Clara's best work.
Chapter 20. At Carl Tracy. Cannot meet you now at Nouveau Gallery. What exactly do you want?
Agent Cloutier smiled. Had she been an angler, she'd have recognized a nibble on the bait. She was also amused and reassured by the cautious, even terse response. But mostly it was the speed of the response that grabbed her attention. This was Carl Tracy's Instagram account, but it was not Carl Tracy she was communicating with. He had no cell phone, and no cell phone coverage.
Best not to discuss business publicly, she typed, having already composed this response in her head. Do you have a private account?
Her phone was ringing the Bonanza theme, and she answered it, but continued to stare at the screen, trying not to see the amused looks of the other Sûreté agents in the open room.
Cloutier,
she said.
It's Beauvoir. The search warrant's come through. Meet us at the Tracy place.
On my way, patron.
But still she stared at the screen, and then, just as she was about to shut it down, a single word appeared. No. Far from being disappointed, Cloutier smiled. It was the response she'd expected, hoped for. A normal potter
approached by a gallery about representing them, would be falling all over themselves to invite them into the private address to talk business. But Carl Tracy or Pauline Vachon or whoever Cloutier was communicating with was not. Now, why was that? Only one answer. They didn't want anyone else to see what was on the private account. Posts, photographs. She had them in her sights now. It would just take a little time, a little teasing, a tastier bait. But she'd get there. She'd get them. With effort, she didn't type the response she'd already formulated. Let them stew. Before leaving, she checked on Homer. Do you need anything? There was no answer. He was staring straight ahead. She wondered what he was seeing, though she could guess. The image he would see for the rest of his life.
We're searching the home. I'm heading there now. We'll get him.
That penetrated at least a little. Homer turned to her and smiled weakly.
Merci, Lisette.
Her fingers were around the bars, and he reached out and touched her hand. It took most of the day to go over the Tracy property. Where the earlier search was for Vivian, today they were looking for her killer and the evidence to convict him. It had been decided that Lacoste would stay behind in the incident room to coordinate the information as it came in and assign agents as necessary. Beauvoir dropped Gamache off at the Tracy house, while he himself continued to the dirt road and the car and the bridge. His team had been there for hours, calling in engineers to first secure the bridge so they could walk on it safely. While one crew did that, another went over the car. Tell me what you know.
There are smears of blood on the outer and inner door handles, the steering wheel and gear shift, a small smear on the trunk handle, and a drop on the back seat.
A drop, not a smear?
Exactly.
The agent showed Beauvoir. It had the telltale splatter of blood that had formed a drop, then hit. Maybe from a bleeding nose or lip.
Prints? Beauvoir asked. From at least three different people. There are butts in the cigarette holder. We bagged them, and we've taken dirt samples from the tyres, of course, to see if we can work out where she's been recently.
Tyre tracks?
None. The rain washed everything away, including boot prints.
Damn, said Beauvoir, looking around.
Chief, said an agent standing by the bridge. We're ready.
Chief?
Oui.
Gamache turned to see Agent Cloutier at the door to the living room.
There's something curious in the bedroom, she said. Something different from when we were here yesterday.
He followed her through the rambling old farmhouse to the bedroom and saw immediately what Agent Cloutier meant. When he was last there, the room was a mess. Now it was tidy. Not perhaps ready for a photo shoot in country living, but far neater than it had been. He brought out his phone.
There's no reception, sir,
said the inspector in charge.
Merci, he said,
and continued to scroll until he found what he was looking for. The photographs he'd downloaded the day before from the first search of the Tracy home.
Here's what this room looked like yesterday when we came looking for Vivienne Godin.
He turned the phone so that the inspector could see. The photo was taken from exactly the place where they now stood. It showed a room in disarray, clothing scattered on the floor and draped on a chair, bed unmade and sheets dirty, though not bloody, which wasn't to say traces of blood weren't there, just unnoticeable except by people trained to find them.
Get Monsieur Tracy up here, please, said Gamache,
and Cloutier hurried away.
We've looked, patron, and we can't find any clothes that obviously belong to Madame Godin.
They heard footsteps on the stairs, and Tracy appeared.
What do you want?
What did you do with your wife's belongings? Asked Gamache.
Well, she didn't need them any more.
How did you know?
You haven't been back here since her body was found, which means you got rid of her things before you knew she was dead. Unless you did know.
All I knew is that she'd left me, and I was pissed off. Before I went to bed last night, I took all her shit and burned it in the kiln.
I'll get scene of crime to check the kiln, said Cloutier, and left.
You cleaned the place with bleach?
The inspector held up a swab.
What can I say? Place was a shithole.
He turned to Gamache.
You saw it. What did you think?
When Gamache didn't answer, Tracy sneered.
I live in a pigsty and you judge. I clean it up and you judge. Well, fuck you. I'm finally free to live the way I want.
They were, Gamache recognised, the words of either an extremely well-balanced person who didn't care what others thought, or a psychopath who didn't care what others thought.
Why in the world do you care what others think?
Demanded Ruth as they sat in the bistro in front of the warm fire.
Because I'm human and live in the world, said Clara, with other humans.
Part of her felt that Ruth was probably right. She shouldn't care. But she also felt there was a criticism there, that Ruth was implying she was weak or needy for caring.
People are cancelling their orders for my works, said Clara.
So?
So this is my life, my career, my livelihood.
What do you need money for anyway? Asked Ruth. We live in a tiny village. We buy clothes from the general store, barter turnips for milk, and the booze is free. Not free, said Olivier, pouring her another shot of what looked like scotch, but was actually cold tea.
There was a suspicion Ruth knew about the substitution, but played along, because, as with so much else in her life, she didn't really care. As she watched Ruth, Clara remembered that in the past few hours, someone had gone onto Twitter and defended her. You ignorant turd. Clara's works are genius. Hashtag Morrow Genius. If it wasn't Ruth, it was someone doing a damn fine imitation of the foul-mouthed poet. Those tweets were trending, not because, Clara realised, they were insightful defences of her creations, but because the tweets were in themselves a form of genius. There was now a Twitter account from someone calling themselves at Ignorant Turd.
You're far too needy,
said Ruth, watching as Rosa dipped her beak into the glass of cold tea. The duck raised her head and muttered, "Fuck, fuck, fuck," apparently realising it wasn't really scotch.
And you, said Clara, are an ignorant turd.
There was a hush as everyone else around the fireplace braced for impact. But Ruth, after a moment, just chuckled.
I'll do it, said Beauvoir, putting out his hand. I think I should, sir, said the young agent. I'm trained.
And once again, Chief Inspector Beauvoir found himself facing what had become a familiar decision tree. In fact, since becoming head of homicide, he'd faced a veritable forest of comments like that, testing his authority and certainly questioning his competence. Once again, he stood at the verbal crossroads. Should he reply, "Give me the testing kit, you stupid shit. How do you think I got to be Chief Inspector? By sitting on my thumbs?" Or should he say, with a patient smile, "That's all right. I do know what I'm doing, but I appreciate your concern." As Gamache might have answered, had indeed answered many times, sometimes in response to Agent Beauvoir's own somewhat insulting comments. When asked about it one night, years into their relationship, Armour had explained with a laugh.
After I'd said something especially patronising to my first chief, he just looked at me and said, "Before speaking, Agent Gamache, you might want to ask yourself three questions."
"Not the ones that lead to wisdom," said Beauvoir, who'd heard them before.
"No, those are statements. These are questions. Are you paying attention?"
"What?" They'd been sitting on the front porch of the Gamache's home in the height of summer, an iced tea beside Beauvoir, a beer beside Gamache. As he spoke, the chief inspector raised a finger, counting the questions.
"Is it true? Is it kind? Does it need to be said?"
"You're kidding, right?" said Jean-Guy, shifting in his seat to look at Armour. "That might work in our private lives, but with other cops, you'd be laughed out of the room."
"You don't necessarily say them out loud," explained the chief.
Which was true. Beauvoir had never heard Gamache run through those questions, but he had heard, more often than not, a patient and constructive reply.
"Civility," Armour had said. "How can we expect it if we don't give it? Besides, when we do get angry, people pay more attention. Otherwise, it's just white noise." "Is it true? Is it kind? Does it need to be said?"
Beauvoir, with effort, ran through the questions as he stood on the bridge, looking at the young agent.
Then he heard himself say, "That's all right. I do know what I'm doing. But thank you."
"You stupid little shit."
Yes, it did need to be said, but maybe not out loud. Though he did now wonder what Gamache had chosen not to say out loud. Beauvoir took the harness from the agent and attached it expertly to himself, then put his hand out for the evidence kit. "I'll go out first. If it's safe, you can join me. One at a time. D'accord?"
"Oui, patron,"
said the agent. Turning around to face the rickety old bridge, Beauvoir took a breath and whispered to himself,
"Don't pee. Don't pee. Don't pee."
Chapter 21. How can they let that murderer back in the Sûreté? Hashtag losing all respect. At dumbass. Do you mean self-respect? They dropped Agent Cloutier at the local detachment and headed through the bright spring day into the morgue. Gamache had insisted on driving when he saw how exhausted Jean-Guy was. Beside him, Jean-Guy's lids were heavy, and he fought to keep his eyes open in the warm car as it moved smoothly along the autoroute.
"I couldn't be happier for Annie and you," said Armand. "Your family is growing."
"As is yours." As an only child, growing up without parents, Armand had always yearned for a large family, for brothers and sisters, for aunts and uncles. It was an abstract, though potent, wish. And now, in his late 50s, he had it. Children, grandchildren, sons and daughters, of the flesh and of the heart. Those he'd held in his arms, and those comrades in arms whose lives he held in his hands. His family.
"When's the baby due?"
"October."
"Boy or girl? Do you know?"
"We do," Jean-Guy smiled at his father-in-law. "But you're not going to get it out of me. Annie and I want to keep that to ourselves."
"Fair enough. Have you chosen a name?"
Jean-Guy laughed. "You're not really very good at this interrogation thing, are you?"
"I'm hoping to learn from you, Padron."
Beauvoir smiled, and Gamache fell silent. Knowing if he did, Jean-Guy would lose the battle and let himself drift off to sleep. He'd told Beauvoir about the search of the Tracy home. Then Beauvoir had reported on their preliminary findings at the bridge. Now Gamache, in the silence as Jean-Guy slept, went back over that conversation. "We lifted 3 sets of fresh prints off the interior of the car," Beauvoir had said. "Probably Vivienne's and Tracy's. But the third?
Can we prove that she wasn't alone? That someone was on the bridge with her?"
"No, that's a problem. The heavy rain washed away all foot and tire prints."
"Shame."
Gamache thought for a moment.
"But we still think she either met someone there, something happened, and she went off the bridge, or..."
"Or Tracy followed her there and killed her."
"But if he wanted her dead, why wait until she left?" mused Gamache, keeping his eyes on the highway. "He struck me as someone who doesn't plan ahead. I can imagine him lashing out and killing her that night, in their home, either on purpose or in a fit of rage. But to follow her..."
"He told you he left her in the living room and went into his studio and drank, right?"
"Oui."
"Maybe he worked himself into a rage, getting angrier and angrier the more he thought about Vivienne and another man. He sees her leave and decides to follow her, thinking she's meeting her lover."
Gamache nodded. That he could see.
"He'd confront them. Do you think there really was a lover?" Beauvoir asked, then yawned.
"Must have been," said Gamache. "At least in your scenario. Otherwise, why would she drive to the bridge?"
"Okay, she goes to meet a lover, but then wouldn't Tracy kill him, too?"
"Maybe he did, but I doubt it," Gamache said. "Like all abusers and bullies, Tracy's a coward. He wouldn't attack someone who could fight back."
"So if he did follow Vivienne, he found her alone on the bridge, waiting, and threw her in."
"What did you find there?"
"I discovered I don't like rotten bridges over rivers in flood."
"Ah," said Gamache. "Most helpful. Anything else?"
"Wouldn't take much to break through the railing. It was broken from the inside out and looks recent.
I think there's little doubt that's where Vivian fell.
Any actual proof?
Not yet. We're testing the wood for fibres and blood. We've removed the section where she broke through, so technicians can take a closer look in the lab. Then there's the duffel bag, said Beauvoir. Lacoste pointed out that most of the clothes are for summer.
Huh, said Gamache. That's strange.
Not the only strange thing. You know those pills in the bag?
Yes.
They're abortion pills.
They're what?
Gamache glanced over quickly before returning his eyes to the road. Medication to end an early pregnancy. Looks like she got them on the black market.
I wonder how far along she was, said Gamache.
It looked to both of them as though she was beyond what could be called an early pregnancy, but the coroner would tell them.
Isabel doesn't think she packed the bag, and neither do I, said Jean-Guy, yawning again.
Between the heat of the car and the gentle hum of the engine, Jean-Guy could feel himself losing the fight to stay alert, to even stay awake.
You think Tracy packed the bag? Said Gamache.
Yes, I think it was a simple mess of a murder. You found blood in the living room, and we found blood in the car. Tracy admits beating her. I think either he killed her in the home, beat her to death, drove her to the bridge, and threw her over, wanting to make it look like suicide or an accident, or he took her there while she was still alive and threw her off.
I don't think he beat her to death in the house. There wasn't enough blood. And if she was still alive, why would she get into the car with him?
Yes, that's a problem. She wouldn't. Not voluntarily, anyway.
So the most likely explanation is that he knocked her unconscious, drove her there, and threw her off the bridge, said Gamache, hoping, like you said, it would look like an accident or suicide. He packed the duffel bag, grabbing things at random, and threw it in after her. But people don't pack for suicide. If that's what he wanted us to believe, he made a mistake.
There's another problem, said Beauvoir. The blood smears are on the driver's side. It looks like she was hurt, but conscious enough to drive.
So she took herself there, said Gamache, considering. And there's no physical evidence of anyone else on that bridge with her?
Not yet. You think he didn't do it?
Tracy? Oh, he did it. It's just a matter of understanding the evidence and getting enough to convict.
He glanced over at his companion. Jean-Guy's eyes were just about closed. Within a minute of Gamache's falling silent, Jean-Guy had fallen asleep. By the time they pulled into the morgue, Gamache had been over that conversation a few times, but was no closer to a solution. When Agent Cloutier returned to the local detachment, she found a very different Homer Godin than the man she'd left.
"How come I'm in here and he's free?"
he demanded.
"Let me out."
"I can't."
"Of course you can. You're a goddamn cop."
Lisette paled, not used to being spoken to that way, and certainly not by Homer. She stared into those angry eyes and knew in her rational mind that it wasn't Homer speaking. It was grief. But though her brain told her that, her heart still recoiled. She saw Homer now in a different light, not as a man, but as a father. Not having children herself, she hadn't quite appreciated the depth of his feeling for his daughter. Now she knew what her friend Kathy had been talking about, that bond between father and daughter. It was almost cliché and, in some cases, mythic. Kathy had long complained, but Lisette, as much as she loved her friend, could understand why Vivian would be drawn to her father and not her mother. Kathy was not demonstrative. She was efficient, kept a clean and tidy and orderly home. But Homer brought the joy into it, as Vivian brought joy into his life. It was a perfect little ecosystem, but it left Kathy on the outside looking in. As soon as Vivian had been born, her father had become simply skin stretched over his love for his daughter. But now she was gone, and there was nothing holding him together, except hatred. Chief Inspector Gamache had seen that before anyone else. He knew, perhaps because of his love for his own daughter, what a person in that position could do, would do, unless they were locked up. Though Agent Lisette Cloutier did just wonder if it would really be such a bad thing if she opened the cell door.
Homer would murder Carl Tracy, of course, but he'd almost certainly be given as light a sentence as the justice system allowed. He would not be held criminally responsible, and he would clearly not be a menace to society, just to one man. She would also be arrested and tried for letting him out, but at least Homer would know what she was willing to do for him. The other agents in the room, including Agent Cameron, looked at her as she returned to her desk and brought up the Instagram account. Do they suspect what I'm considering doing? Did it matter? Lisette Cloutier looked down at her computer and saw, again, the curt no on the screen, now a few hours old. She typed in her own reply. At Nouveau Gallery. Sorry. Busy with buyers. No worries. Lots of other promising ceramicists. I'm sure you have other options. Good luck to you. Within 2 minutes, there was a reply. Again, terse, but enough. It contained an invitation to join Carl Tracy's private Instagram account. Chapter 22. At Nouveau Gallery. Thanks for the access. Looked at your work. Ceramic pieces promising, but not right for the gallery. Good luck, at Carl Tracy. At Serious Collector. Rethinking the Morrow portrait I bought. Three old women laughing. Weaker than I first thought. Sort of superficial. Holy shit. Check out this video. Hashtag Gamache sucks. There was, Gamache knew, an unmistakable smell about a morgue. Not the sickly aroma of rot. He could pick that up from a distance after years of approaching corpses and killers. No, the morgue smelled of extreme, almost severe, cleanliness. It turned his stomach. As the door swung open, sterile air met him, and he braced himself. But Armand Gamache knew the slight sick feeling in the pit of his stomach this time went beyond the smell, went beyond even the gnawing thought that this could be Annie on the metal slab. Only once before in his career had he felt this particular sensation. It was doubt. Not that they could find the killer, he was pretty sure they'd already done that, but that they could convict him. That other time, his first year as head of homicide, he had indeed failed, and the killer had gone free. And now he looked down at the body of Vivien Godin, saw her bruises, saw the incision on her belly, and felt that wave of nausea, that fear that whoever did this would walk free. What do you have? Jean-Guy Beauvoir asked Dr. Harris. As you can see, the body is badly damaged. Some trauma clearly post-mortem, but some done while she was alive.
She was beaten, said Beauvoir.
Well
what? He snapped, then put up his hands in apology. Dizzily.
It's okay. I feel it too. This is a particularly nasty case. The problem is, I can't say for sure which injuries, if any, were done in a beating just before she died, and which ones were caused by being battered in the river while still alive. There are some obviously older bruises.
Dr. Harris pointed to some yellow and greenish blotches on Vivian's arms and legs.
But these, the coroner pointed to other marks on Vivian's body, are harder to explain.
They're fresh, said Gamache.
Oui, but what made them? A person? Or rocks and tree limbs? She'd have been tossed around in the floodwaters. That could have done a lot, even all of the damage we see.
They looked down at Vivian's naked, battered body. The fetus, asked Gamache. How far along?
I'd say she'd be about 20 weeks.
She? Said Beauvoir. A baby girl?
Jean-Guy paled and looked across the body, to his father-in-law, and Armand knew then. Annie and Jean-Guy were having a daughter. A baby girl. Yes.
If Dr. Harris noticed this moment between the two men, she chose not to say anything.
What I can say for sure is that she was alive when she went into the river. There's water in her lungs.
If questioned on the stand, said Gamache, giving Jean-Guy a moment to compose himself, what would you say about the bruising?
She considered the body again. Some of her wounds could have happened before she went into the water, but most have signs of battering consistent with being hit by rocks. It's a sort of tumbling action as a body's swept along.
You say most of the wounds are consistent with battering in the water?
said Bovard, recovered. But not all. There are two bruises that are harder to explain. She pointed to Vivian's upper chest, just below the collarbone. Bovard and Gamache leaned closer. At first it looked like one large blue mark spreading across her chest. But looking closer, they could see other marks, like something trapped below the surface, one on either side. Armand put on his glasses and leaned closer still.
What do you think made them?
At a guess, Dr. Harris raised her hands, palms toward them, then thrust forward.
She was shoved, said Beauvoir.
He looked at Gamache, who nodded.
Oui.
She put her hands over the bruises.
You can see that the hands are quite big.
Could you say for sure those marks were made by a person and not by debris? Gamache asked. Dr. Harris sighed.
I've been struggling with that. I'm not sure I could swear to it. What I can say is that the chances of two identical bruises happening while she was being tossed about in the river are astronomical. These, she looked back down at Vivian, were done at the same time, by the same thing. The only explanation I have is that she was pushed, violently.
Intentionally.
Maybe in a fit of rage, but yes, whoever did this wanted to shove her back, hard.
Can you measure those bruises? Gamache asked.
To give you the size of the hand? I could, but it wouldn't be very accurate. There's weeping of the blood around the edges. Again, any defence will argue, quite rightly, that the hand could have been smaller. Besides, a lot of people have hands that big.
Tracy's hands, Gamache knew, were not large. But as the hands of a potter, they'd be powerful. And he could think of one person related to the case whose hands were very big. Bob Cameron. Left tackle's hands. And what did a left tackle do? He pushed and shoved. Violently. Perhaps, at this stage, instinctively. When threatened.
Any idea how long she's been dead? Asked Beauvoir. 2, maybe 3 days. The water was cold, so that has to be taken into account. This is Tuesday. I'd say she went into the river on Saturday night, maybe at a stretch early Sunday morning.
Gamache was nodding, thinking, and finally asked the question Jean-Guy Beauvoir did not seem willing to ask. Is there any evidence, any proof, that she was murdered?
Sharon Harris paused before answering. I'm sorry, I looked. Hard. But I can't find anything. It could have been suicide. It could have been an accident. I think she was murdered. I think she was hit so hard in the chest she fell off the bridge. But as for absolute proof...
She raised her hands. No.
And the blood work? Beauvoir asked. Very preliminary. None of the more detailed results yet. But I can tell you that she'd been drinking.
She was drunk? Asked Beauvoir.
No, but she'd had a few ounces of alcohol shortly before her death. No sign of drugs, but if there are just traces, that won't show up until I get the detailed report. I've put a rush on it, and we should have something by later this afternoon.
Can you ask them to check for this? Beauvoir brought out the pill bottle in its sterile baggie. Dr. Harris examined it while Gamache walked back to Vivian's body. He looked down at her, at the wounds caused by the river, by the fall, by her husband, and by the coroner, who'd cut into this young woman in an effort to find out who'd caused the other wounds. He picked up her hand to tuck it next to her body and draw the sheet over her. The hand was, as he expected, cold. It would have shocked him to the core had Vivian's hand been warm. He held it for a moment and realized he was, unconsciously, trying to comfort her. He noticed then that there was a gash on her palm.
Doctor, what's this? It looks like a defensive wound.
Not from a knife, she said, joining him.
Too jagged.
Could it have been caused by reaching out for the railing? Gamache asked. And having it break? Dr. Harris lifted up Vivian's hand to take a closer look. Then, stepping away from the body, Dr. Harris stood straight and lifted both hands in front of her. Anyone would have thought she was being threatened by the two Sûreté officers. Her face was intent, her body rigid in feigned alarm. Then she leaned away from them and reached behind her with her right hand.
What height is the railing?
98 centimetres, said Beauvoir. Dr. Harris adjusted her hand to just over 3 feet off the floor. Then she nodded and walked over to her desk. Doing quick calculations of Vivien Caudin's height, the height of the railing, the angle of the cut on her hand, and the likely trajectory of her body, the coroner then returned to the metal slab.
What's the thickness of the handrail?
Beauvoir needed to consult his notes for that, and gave the dimension to her. Harris measured the wound and re-examined it closely.
Still no splinters, but I'll do a microscopic examination. There might be something wedged into the flesh. It looks likely that it was caused when she fell and not when she was in the water.
How can you tell that? Asked Beauvoir, stepping closer.
Because the cut starts here,
Harris pointed to just above Vivian's wrist where the palm began,
and tears up to her middle finger. It would be unlikely a cut like this would be made when a person was going headfirst down the river. Her hands would be out in front of her, if possible, and a cut would go from fingers down, not wrist up.
You think it was made when she was going backward, not forward, said Gamache, also moving closer. He put his glasses back on.
I do.
So Vivien was pushed backward while on the bridge, said Beauvoir. And when Dr. Harris didn't contradict him, he went on, she reached for the railing, he also mimicked the action, to stop herself, and it broke. There was what felt like an eternal silence while the two Sûreté officers stared at the coroner, and the careful coroner considered.
Probably.
Yes, Beauvoir clenched both fists in excitement, knowing what that would mean to their investigation.
Probably, said Gamache, more cautious, but not definitive.
No, it's likely that's what happened. I could testify to it. But the defence could argue that it was caused in the water, that her body was twisting around, so it was at times going backward down the river, and that's when the cut was made. It would be difficult, but just possible. I'd have to testify to that, too.
What do you need to be sure? Asked Gamache.
What we don't have. A splinter that matches the wood from the railing.
Then she paused.
You say it was rotten?
Oui, said Beauvoir, perking up, noticing the slight shift in her tone.
Very.
Do you have a sample?
We've removed that whole section. It's in the lab.
Good. Have them test for spores, for algae, for microscopic traces of organisms. Lots of things make their home in rotting wood and flesh. I'll take samples from the cut and test as well. It's possible not everything was flushed out. We'll see if what's found on the wood matches what's in the cut.
And if it does, that would place her on that bridge, said Gamache, going backward through the railing. It would prove the wound wasn't made after she went into the water.
Yes, absolutely.
But, said Gamache.
But, said Beauvoir, looking at him, knowing what he was thinking and coming to the same conclusion.
But what?
Asked Dr. Harris. Gamache nodded to Beauvoir, inviting the lead investigator to explain.
A clever defence would still argue that she might have tripped. She was drinking, after all. She might have just lost her balance and fallen backward. Or she might have been leaning against the rail and it broke. That I can refute, said the coroner. By the angle of the cut, she was at least 2 feet from it when she reached back and fell.
Or was pushed, said Beauvoir.
Against it. And, yes, she was trying to save herself. So you can rule out suicide, at least.
Gamache exhaled. It was far from the first time he'd stood over the corpse of a woman who'd been punched and kicked, belittled and shamed, and pushed to the end of her rope, and beyond. Vivien Caudin, it seemed, had reached the end, and had made a choice that cold and dark April night. She'd chosen life, for herself and her baby girl. Le beau risque, the great risk, the beautiful risk, to climb out of the hole and start again. Like Annie and Jean-Guy heading to Paris with their young and growing family, away from the dangers here, to start fresh. But while they could escape, Vivien could not. Once again, Gamache felt the tightening in his stomach. Isabelle Lacoste stood in the doorway of the Cowansville detachment, leaning on her cane, and looked around the open room.
She's over there, said the receptionist,
waving toward Agent Cloutier working at her laptop.
Merci.
But the receptionist had already left. Heads turned as she limped through the room. There was about her an air of ease and confidence. This stranger who belonged. Then, one by one, they realized this was no stranger. Though most had never met Superintendent Lacoste, they knew her by reputation, knew what she'd done, and what had, as a result, been done to her, the cane being only the most visible sign.
Superintendent,
said one young agent, getting up to stand at his desk.
Bonjour,
said Lacoste, not bothering to correct him and explain she was on leave, though the rank still held.
Agent Cloutier,
said Lacoste as she approached the desk. Lisette Cloutier gave a start and looked up into the familiar face. Then she quickly stood up, smiling.
Patron, I didn't expect to see you. I thought you'd be with the chief inspector.
Zzz. Lacoste laughed. With more than one, the grammar became problematic.
I've struck out on my own, she said. Are you free?
For sure. Do you need my help?
You seem to be working on something. I traced the IP address for Carl Tracy's website. It's through a local server, and the billing address is a home here in Cowansville, registered in the tax rolls to the same woman I told you about last night, Pauline Vachon.
Lacoste was slightly surprised Lisette Cloutier could remember anything from their call the night before.
So that confirms it, she said, taking a seat. And we have an address.
Well done. The website was on Cloutier's laptop, and Lacoste scrolled through. It showed a man bending over a wheel, intent on the lump of clay he was forming. Down the sides of the page, there were photographs of different works.
Huh,
said Lacoste.
Quite nice. Yes, he's talented.